Hello, welcome to the LDCU Talking Online Learning Podcast, Episode 7. My name is Jim Judges and I'm a Senior Academic Technologist at Warwick, supporting the use of educational technology, including Moodle, Teams and much more. This series of podcasts is aimed at capturing some of the experiences and ideas related to the move to online distance and blended learning. If you have something to share and would be prepared to be interviewed either individually, in a pair or as a small group, then please do get in touch. So in this episode, I caught up with Alexa Cacoldi from WMG and Chloe Agg from Engineering, who firstly tell us about their use of the Moodle checklist tool and some research they're embarking on. They also share some interesting and useful reflections on their experiences with online learning, including some challenges as well as some of the positives as well. In the second half of the podcast, I speak to Lee Griffin from WMG and what he doesn't know about Microsoft Teams and, in fact, Excel isn't worth knowing. Well, he knows a lot more than me anyway. But he is also a very experienced online tutor and he's been teaching online from well before the start of the pandemic, as he explains. Lee also gives us some great insights into his own online activity and some useful examples and tips. So, let's get cracking. So, I'm here with Chloe Agg and Alexa Cacoldi, but rather than me introduce you, perhaps I'll ask you to introduce yourself alphabetically. Alexa, could you go first?
Absolutely. Thanks for having us today, Jim. So I'm Alexa Cacoldi. I'm from WMG. I'm a senior teaching fellow in supply chain and logistics. And I'm here really today to talk about some of the experiences that I've had in terms of moving from face-to-face to small group teaching through the lockdown and now onto online teaching. In terms of my sort of teaching load, I teach a fourth year module for the School of Engineering and Supply Chain Management. I am course leader for the BEng course in Engineering Business Management. I am module leader for the Engineering Business Management Group Project, which is the third year module. And I also co-lead the engineering third year projects with Chloe. So over to Chloe.
Thank you very much. So I am Chloe Agg. I am a senior teaching fellow in the School of Engineering. So I am the module leader for the dissertation projects alongside Alexa. So we have a cohort of about 300-350 students on that. And as well as that, I am the module leader for second year engineering design with a cohort of about 120 students.
So plenty to keep you busy there. It will be good to talk about some of the general themes related to online learning, but I'm also specifically interested in your use of Moodle checklists. So if you don't mind, could we talk about that first and then broaden things out? So who wants to tell me about how that project is going? Perhaps for anybody who doesn't know what Moodle checklist is, you can tell us what it is, perhaps how you're using it and what stage you're at.
I think if I explain how we use it on the dissertation projects, because Alexa's also using it on one of her modules, as my second year module is just about to start, so I don't have any information on that one yet. So on our dissertation projects, like I say, that's got a cohort of 300-350 students. There's not a lot of taught content on it, and every year students are anxious about it. It's hard to know what you should be doing with such an open-ended project that goes on for two terms. And the students all have a supervisor, and the supervisors do their best to advise students, but obviously they have a variable amount of knowledge about the project. Some of them have been doing it for years, some of them are brand new. To deal with that anxiety, which we knew would be far more this year with the pandemic, with everyone being remote, but also just everyone's anxiety levels being far higher, we really wanted to help the students with that. And so what we decided to do was to introduce Moodle checklists. If you've not used a Moodle checklist before, it's a really handy little add-in. You can just go in and list out activities you think students can do. If you want to, you can embed links within those and students can enter into that and tick things off as they go along to give themselves a sense of being on the right track and a sense of achievement, but also some guidance as to where to find materials, what they need to complete, and all that kind of good stuff.
Well, Alexa, how are you using it and what stage are you at?
Okay, so I'm using Moodle checklists on a taught module. So it's a fourth year level seven module taught to the School of Engineering, and I've got 60 students on the module this year. It was taught in term one. So I had the luxury of some face-to-face time with the students in very small seminar groups to comply with guidelines. But I also had different parts of the cohort at disparate times during the week, some online, some face-to-face, and a mixture week by week. So I use checklists to, like Chloe said, guide the students in terms of what they should be achieving each week, but also to keep consistency across the cohort, because I was seeing them via different methodologies, and maybe people weren't available some weeks, poorly, all of that kind of stuff. So I used them to make sure that the students were engaging, firstly, in the asynchronous material. So all of those lovely videos that we spent hours and hours pre-recording for the students, to make sure that they were engaging with those. I used them to signpost them to additional reading, both of book chapters and of papers to support their learning and their reading. I use them to, I use the checklist to signpost the students to their preparation for the following week's seminars. So really to keep them on track, just as we would do if we were teaching face-to-face, you would be telling them at the end of each lecture that this is what they had to do for next week to prepare. I was using them for that purpose as well. Sorry, Jim, you're asking me to...
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask you really, because I'm interested to hear where you're using it. But for anybody who hasn't started to use the tool yet, they might think, well, why can't I just use Moodle to check what's going on? Because Moodle will tell me if a student has done something. So what do you think is the benefit of the student ticking off what they've done rather than getting Moodle to tell you if they've done something? Do you want to say anything about that, Alexa, and then Chloe as well?
Yeah, I think, as Chloe alluded to earlier, definitely the sense of achievement that they've done something and they're keeping on track. I think also to communicate to them the level of engagement that they actually do need in a module, because even though they're not getting that those three or four taught hours a week that are face-to-face, they're still expected to engage. So sense of achievement, sense of engagement, and also from the students' perspective, we always get some that are more engaged and some that are less engaged, but this allowed me to on occasions mention when I was face-to-face, either online or physically with the students, that actually I'd noticed that some students were really engaged and they'd done this and this last week, and actually some of them hadn't. Obviously I never named names, but it was quite a useful tool to
yes,
to give them that additional push to engage.
And what about yourself, Chloe? Have you got any thoughts on that side of things?
It's a really interesting question, actually, because you've got two quite similar tools on the face of it. What's the difference? The difference, I would say, is about who's got the ownership of that. So when you're setting up course completion, you've decided when a task will be completed and you've decided which tasks matter. On a checklist, the students tick it off. So the students decide when they think they finished it. So, you know, on course completion, it's really easy to go, well, students looked at the page, they've completed it. Well, a student might not feel they finished it at that point. They want to look at it once and they want to come back and read in detail later. And they want to be able to say, I've now completed that. I feel it is finished. I'm done with this page. It's done. I'm going to mark that off on my checklist. But also students can add things to checklists if you permit them to. So they've got a real ownership of it. So which is why for me, the checklists were all about student reassurance, student ownership, students feeling in control of their projects. However, the downside of that student ownership, I would say, is if you want to use it to make sure you're keeping track of who's progressing with what, students don't have to tick anything off. And so actually, we have a percentage disengagement according to our checklists, which doesn't necessarily correlate with student disengagement in their projects. So if you're okay, using it for learner analytics, it's not necessarily going to give you the same outcomes as course completion.
No, that's interesting. And I am aware of other departments, perhaps up in the medical school, where they're using both, and there's nothing to stop you using a combination. But I must admit, at a time when there's a lot of ongoing talk about learning analytics, that it does seem giving students responsibility is important, and reassurance to know what is important and to check check if they've done what's required. But also, I have a feeling that we're also developing a useful life skill if they haven't got it already, because checklists are pretty useful in the working world and whatever we do, aren't they? So it's a good skill.
Yeah. Actually, on our dissertation projects, one of our so we're accredited by the Engineering Council, and the Engineering Council therefore set us some of our learning outcomes, and one of those is about continuous professional development, and the students need to be able to plan their own learning, their own development, and they also need to plan their own projects and manage their own time. All of those learning outcomes are associated with this module, so actually the use of checklists on it is quietly and subversively teaching them some of those skills without them necessarily realizing. I think so,
and there is something powerful about, rather than Big Brother and the system watching you, then why not watch yourself? But now, I know that, and perhaps we should mention this, that you're taking this a little bit further and hoping to do some research, as well as being interested in perhaps reaching out to other folks. So what stage are you at with that, and what are you hoping to do with any data that you might be able to get hold of, Alexa?
For me personally, this would be my first dipping my toe in the water in terms of publishing something. So it's something that I'm passionate about. It's something that I've got growing interest in, and something that this time last year never thought we would have the opportunity to be involved in. So actually, thank you, COVID. That's probably the only thing that we're thanking COVID for getting us to kind of think in a different way. So in terms of publishing something, I think, as Chloe's already alluded to, we need to think about engagement versus disengagement, completion versus non-completion, and actually how does that correlate with the actual engagement that students have in their learning. So, you know, we've already sort of looked at some of the data and thought, well, actually, the data is telling us that three students haven't engaged in this at all. I wonder if those will be the three students that actually do really not particularly well in the post-module assessment. So I think definitely we need to get a clearer idea of what the data is telling us and how to interpret it. We obviously need to do some further analysis and prove out some of the hypotheses that we're coming out with, like the one that I've just mentioned. So I think it's going to be a longer period of thinking actually about where the data can take us. I also think there's potentially a big difference between the two modules that we've trialed the checklists in already, because obviously one's taught, one's self-motivated in terms of what the students are doing. They're at different levels from a QAA perspective. So I think we've got a lot more to do in terms of working out where the research could take us.
Okay. Thanks for that. And that sounds interesting and great that you're able to perhaps compare and contrast those different types of modules and different levels. And it'd be interesting to see what other experiences like elsewhere. What about yourself, Chloe? What's your interest in this project, or what stage are you at?
Yeah, so similar to Alexa about wanting to check out what is the data really telling us. So, for example, we see a really steep decline in people's engagement with the checklists, particularly on the dissertation module. I'd like to know whether that is because our engagement was boosted by the checklists and then it's come down to maybe normal levels, or is it that decline because at the beginning of the project they haven't got their relationship with their supervisor established, they don't know what they're doing with their projects, and they're much more reliant on the checklists, and that decline is because they're starting to establish their own ways of working. So actually that whole learning about self-management and time management through using the checklists, it's working for them, so they don't need the checklists anymore. Are they weaning themselves off it? I would be interested to know about that. But also we are starting with some collaborations, so we're just starting to talk to maths about their usage of it. And I also teach on a third year design module where they have a group project, and fascinatingly they had checklists just as a one-off and not one student ticked a box on it. And I'd love to look further into that. Is that because it was a one-off and they didn't know how to use it, or are they not engaging with the checklist because they're a group and no one wants to be the person responsible for ticking something off on behalf of a group? So it'd be interesting to do a comparison between individual and group usages of checklists, I think.
That's something that we could possibly pick up next academic year when ES410 and ES3G9 kick off again.
Because you handily teach a group project as well as an individual one.
Yes, absolutely. So that's possibly some data that we could target to collect next academic year.
Perfect collaboration, Alexa. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay, and if anybody has just started out using it, or if anybody's got something to share, then you'd welcome them to get in touch.
Absolutely, please do. We'd love to have a larger data set to compare so we can have something more meaningful in our research and publication.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with that. And please do continue to keep us posted on progress. I'm very interested in that area. It's such a simple tool, but powerful one, I can't help thinking. I wonder if you don't mind if we could just broaden things out and just have a short reflection on the wider move. So much has happened since last March. And the move to online learning, of course, has been a big part of that. Do you mind sharing some of your experiences of switching to online learning, and maybe talking about how students are coping with that, as well as any tips, advice, and any lessons learned. So first of all, Alexa, how have you found it generally? Any reflections and general experiences?
Yeah, I think once the university guidelines were clear about what was expected and what wasn't expected in terms of synchronous and asynchronous teaching, things got an awful lot easier, because I think last summer there was a lot of hearsay about what was and wasn't expected. So for me, I think one of the biggest challenges was changing a taught module that's very face-to-face, that's very subjective in its nature, into a module that was being delivered online asynchronously, and breaking it down into bite-sized chunks that the students could engage with. So rather than having, you know, an hour's lecture on a particular topic, I took the decision really early to break down each of my hour-long sections into 20, 15, 20-minute bite-sized pieces to allow the students to listen to one bit, engage with it, and then be able to go back later. Obviously referencing backwards and forwards, making the students aware at the beginning of a topic that it was broken down into three or four sections. So that was the first thing that I did. I suppose the second thing that became really obvious to me was that it might only take you an hour to deliver a lecture, but to record an hour's worth of lecture material took probably, I don't know, 10 times as long, easily 10 times as long, particularly in the beginning when you're trying to get things absolutely right, trying not to and tut and all of those things that you would do quite naturally when you were speaking. And, you know, if you get tongue-tied in a lecture, you just say, actually, what I meant was, let me express that a bit more clearly for you. You can't do that on a video. You have to go back and re-record it. So I think definitely the recording of asynchronous material was really heavy going until I got into the swing of it, I think.
Chloe, what about yourself? Just thinking generally about that move and indeed any challenges and lessons learned?
I think we touched on it earlier, speaking about the student reassurance, and I would say that was true for staff as well. So I think the thing I found hardest was the sense of this professionally screaming into the void. You know, when I teach to students, yeah, I got into teaching because I like engaging with students. I like seeing those light bulb moments when they start to understand something. I like seeing them enjoying the sessions I'm teaching. I do a lot of seminar-based teaching, partly for those reasons, rather than lecture-based teaching. But of course, putting it all online, especially in that first period of the lockdown, where we there weren't the guidelines and we weren't experienced at it, and we hadn't done things like set up checklists. We were producing lecture materials. Alexa and I worked on quite a lot of short videos. We tried out lots of different styles, and you'd put them out there, and we published websites full of useful information for the students who had asked us questions about their dissertation projects, and you put it all out there. And I think actually largely because we produced good materials, the students didn't have a lot of questions. So there was not a lot of feedback and interaction. So it really did feel like just screaming into the void. And actually that's part of why we ended up using, well, I wouldn't say it was why we ended up using checklists, but it was one of the unexpected bonuses of checklists was that we could see that students were actively engaging with the materials we were using. And suddenly you were getting this feedback, and it felt far more like, much better for my mental health, never mind the students.
This is good. And if you don't mind, yeah, I've got this obvious interest, I suppose we all have, because of the difficulty for our students being at a distance, being isolated. One of the themes that comes through is understandably the loneliness and the isolation and the lack of community that they might otherwise experience. And that's why I was just interested, Alexa, just to pursue this personal interest in, you mentioned you'd done some face-to-face teaching. Have you also got groups that you've only taught online, and have you got any observations, but also have either of you got any solutions on how we deal with that difficult challenge?
Yeah, so there were a definite group of students on my fourth year taught module last year that I was aware of right from the beginning that didn't want to or weren't able to attend face to face. And there was probably about 15 of them altogether that I saw every single week during an online seminar. There were also students that I'd seen face to face that dipped into that online seminar as and when they couldn't attend face to face for whatever reason. But the students that I just saw online, I actually think that I had a better rapport and built a relationship more quickly with them. And I hate to say this, it's because I could see their faces. It's because they weren't wearing masks. I wasn't distracted by a visor. And I felt the communication was a little bit more natural. We also had some laughs along the way, mainly due to my lack of ability to work the technology at times. But I don't think it was a disadvantage to only seeing students online. And in fact, I saw one of the students yesterday that had come face to face every week religiously. And yesterday, during a drop-in, was the first time I'd seen him without a mask. And I said to him, "It's really nice to see your face because I've got no idea what you look like." And he said to me, "Well, I hope you're pleased with what you see." And I said, "Well, I couldn't possibly comment." And we had a little bit of a joke and a laugh. But actually, I think it was easier to build up a rapport with some of the students.
That's interesting. That's interesting to hear, and possibly counterintuitive to what you might expect. But of course, that's because of the mask and the difficulty and perhaps the anxiety associated with meeting in physical space. Chloe, have you got any observations on that, or indeed on possibly building the community, or even getting to and supporting students who might be more isolated than some?
Oh, do you know what? That's been so hard. Alexa and I, on the dissertation module, tried so many different methods for trying to build a community and get engagement. And to be fair, it's always a challenge on the dissertation module anyway, because they're all doing such disparate things because it is individual projects. So no two are the same. So communities are hard because they don't feel like they've got something to share, although, you know, in hindsight, they always realise they did. So we tried forums, and we tried sort of fun blogs. So like Alexa and I posted, "Here's something we did over the summer." So there's photos of me falling in water and Alexa on a beautiful holiday in Italy. Here's our pets. So there's a photo of Alexa's lovely dog Elsie and my fat cat Gatto. We did get a couple of photos of student pets. I've met someone's tortoise now. Excellent. But largely students didn't want to engage either in the sort of blogs or in the more formal, you know, "Have you got questions about this topic? Do you want to share what you're doing on this topic?" Building a community is so hard, but it's definitely what the students are lacking. And I could see this through the sheer volume of emails I was getting and the sort of questions that normally the students would be asking each other while they're waiting for you to start a lecture or whatever else. They don't feel comfortable either due to anxiety levels necessarily asking those perceived silly questions of their peers. Yes. So I had literally thousands of emails last term. It was tiring. So how do we build those communities? I don't have an answer for it, but I think it's something where we need to engage with the students to see what they would be willing to engage it with. And I wonder whether we need to build on the communities they had pre-COVID anyway, things like their WhatsApp chat groups.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, it's a tough nut to crack, and it's one that many of us and many of your colleagues will be grappling with. Have you got any experience with that, Alexa, about trying to coax students into taking part? Have you got any experience?
Yeah, certainly from a a face-to-face perspective, lots of experience both working within WMG and within the School of Engineering, and I very much use some of those skills within the face-to-face seminars. And just actually aligned to the last topic that we were talking about, I did notice in terms of engagement and attendance that quite ordinarily in a usual term you would see attendance at lectures quite high at the beginning, and you would see a definite tail off towards the end of term as deadlines, priorities, boredom, all of that lot kicks in with the students. But last term, in terms of the face-to-face attendance, it was very steady all through term. I had absolutely excellent attendance all the way through. And I can say that actually probably 90% of the students attended every single week, which was fantastic because it told me that I was doing something right, or they were taking their one opportunity to get out of the house each week. It was one or the other. But in terms of seminars, yes, I used the breakout room facilities. I think they worked well with lots of little breakouts with twos and threes. They also worked really well with maybe fives and sixes and sevens because it gave more opportunity for more opinions to be collected. Although when there was bigger breakouts, there was always the chance that some of those that were less willing to contribute were able to sit back. I also try to encourage students, you know, we've talked about this teaching into the void. We're all very used to sitting in front of a screen with a set of initials of various students in front of us. And I find that very disconcerting in terms of, I don't know how people are perceiving what I'm saying. You can read a lot through somebody's face. So when they were in those breakout rooms, even if they weren't happy to in the larger forum, I really encouraged them to put their cameras on and to engage with the people that they were working with. I also quite quickly got to recognise who was willing to contribute. You've always got somebody that wants to talk a lot, like Chloe and I. She's laughing at me now. You might need to edit this bit out, Jim. You always got to recognise the students that were willing to engage and had something to say, either because they'd done the prep or that was just part of their personality. And then there was always the students that you recognised that weren't so comfortable, didn't want to, were more reluctant. So I worked quite hard to pair up similar personalities. So I might have put two people that were very willing to talk together, so that they had to learn the capacity of listening, and two or three very quiet people together to essentially make them talk. But then being quite respectful of when I pulled everybody back together into the larger forum, that I was less persuasive with those that weren't quite as willing to talk in the larger forum. Sure. And let those that were willing to talk have a bit more of a say at that point, so that nobody felt uncomfortable and it didn't put them off coming along the next time.
Yes,
and it seemed to work because certainly the feedback from the students in the end of term module review was pretty good.
Right, some good tips there. And Chloe, before we wrap things up, do you have any tips as far as that's concerned, or any experience in terms of coaxing some of these students to participate?
Absolutely. So we teach all of our first years in small cohorts to support their maths learning, because if they fail their maths course, they can't sit on the degree in the School of Engineering. So it's pretty important that they can do maths. So we have weekly tutorials on that with cohorts of 5 to 6. And I've been using Padlet for it. So Padlet's great because I can set up a sheet for them and the students all upload their workings, their maths workings, to the practice questions each week. And it's great because I can see who's engaging and who's struggling with what. But it also means the students can learn from each other. So they can see each other's workings, and where they're finding something hard, they can look at each other's work. They upload that in advance of our session, and then we use it during the session. So I teach very much with the students explaining to each other the questions they got stuck on the basis, you know, teaching is the best way of learning and consolidating your learning. So what we're able to do is the students can either click on it in Padlet themselves, the workings of the student who's explaining, or I can share my screen and click on the workings just to manage it, make it easy for everyone if someone's not managed to log in to Padlet or whatever else, or can't find the right thing. And it's just been a really nice way of getting the students to be able to share their work and talk about it.
That sounds like a great idea. And what sort of size audience or size grouping would you be having there?
typically.
So that is groups of 5 to 6.
Yeah.
But I know of colleagues who are using it for slightly larger groups for design projects and things, for getting students to share their ideas.
That's great. And as you say, it's not until you stand up or even sit down and try and explain and present something to someone when you realise whether you understand something or not. That is right. Yes, this is all fascinating. I know we could talk all day. Sadly, we do have other things to do. But perhaps I could ask in general if there's anything else you wanted to mention, but also whether or not you if there's anybody who's kind of following behind and just starting out on this journey and planning some teaching for later this term or next term, whether you have any general advice and tips, or even if there's something you've found out that you wish you knew earlier. How about yourself, Chloe?
So I think when we first started out back in sort of May, June last year, starting to make materials, I was so anxious about filming things and getting it right. And everything I made took me such a long time, not only to film and refilm every time I made an error and repeat that endlessly and then edit all together and then caption and all of that, but actually even just psyching myself up to do it. And making sure I had the perfect lighting set up, which had me with like 5 different house lamps that I gathered, and making sure I'd done my makeup, and you know, I'm not a makeup wearer, so that was quite a big deal for me. So you know, I got myself really wound up about it. And Alex and I did lots of different types of recordings, and we asked the students which they preferred. And largely what they preferred was things with voiceover, not our faces. Now, I don't know whether that's about mine and Alexa's faces. It's a little bit awkward. But what I would say is perhaps your audio is more important than your video. And as loads of us feel more comfortable speaking than being seen speaking, concentrate on having a reasonable audio setup, whether that is buying yourself a little lapel mic or making sure you've got a headset with recording. Test your audio out on something for just a couple of minutes, and focus on speaking clearly over maybe some PowerPoint slides or a sketch or whatever else, but don't fuss about everything looking perfect.
How about yourself, Alexa? Any general reflections or tips, advice?
Yeah, just thinking back to actually the face-to-face and the online seminars that I was talking about previously, I had to work really quite hard, and much harder than I would have had to have done normally in a face-to-face lecture, to get the students to contribute. And I think the way that I was successful in that, and I'm saying I was successful because the module feedback told me that I was really to maintain a sense of humour and not be afraid to try out different things. So in terms of my face-to-face and my online seminars last term, I use quite a wide variety of methodologies to collect student feedback. So one week I ask them to do a minute presentation. Another week I set up a mini negotiation. Another week I ask them to produce a Visio flowchart or just a hand-drawn flowchart. Another week I did a round the table or round the breakout groups, 3 points from each group. So don't be afraid to experiment with different ways of pulling feedback from students, and also don't be afraid to experiment with the ways that you present information. So different weeks the students had different types of preparation to do. So some weeks I gave them a newspaper article to read, some weeks I gave them a book chapter to read, some weeks I gave them an old exam question to read. So don't be afraid of mixing and matching and trying different things to keep the variety for the students, because even though you might be concentrating on a different topic each week, delivering the topic and collecting the feedback in the same way also sets in, I guess, boredom for the students. So them coming along and not quite knowing what they were going to expect, and that those words came out of a student's mouth one week, I never could know quite what to expect when I come to your seminars. I think variety is good, and don't be scared to experiment with different methodologies. And if it goes wrong, have a laugh about it together and move on.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is that fear that we don't want to make a fool of ourselves, and we're sometimes anxious and nervous about trying something new. But on the whole, students are pretty supportive, and we get it right more often than we get it wrong, I'm sure. That's good. And it's good to know that variety is the spice of life is still a good mantra. Can I thank you both for your time today? It's really interesting to hear about the checklist project, but also interesting to hear your general reflections. I'll look forward to keeping in touch and hearing how things go. So thanks, Chloe.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thanks, Alexa.
Thanks, Jim. It was really good to talk to you.
So I'm here with Lee Griffin, but rather than me introduce you, perhaps Lee, you could introduce yourself.
Sure, thanks, Jim. I'm Lee Griffin, and I'm an associate professor in WMG, and I'm the discipline lead for accounting and finance, and I'm also the academic lead for careers and skills. By profession, I'm not actually an academic, I'm a chartered accountant, so sorry about that.
Okay, thanks for that. No need to apologise, but perhaps we could jump in the deep end and ask you straight away, just generally, for any thoughts and comments and on what's been your experience of switching to online learning. And perhaps it'd be worth putting that into context because you have already had lots of experience even before the rest of us. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, we deliver a series of courses to the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. And during the issues in Hong Kong in late 2019, that was used as a base of operations by the students. You may have seen on the news on fire, which was making it very difficult for us to deliver any modules there. And not only are the students in Hong Kong, but the students from there are around China and the Far East anyway. And we considered, rather than forever stalling delivering the modules that we had to, the easiest thing to do was to try doing it online. And we chose Teams as a method for doing it, mostly because the university already had it and the students already had access to it. So purely from pragmatism, we decided to do that. And we delivered several modules in the late autumn through to 2019, through to the early spring of 2020. And then as we could see COVID mounting and it became inevitable there'd be some form of UK lockdown, myself and my colleagues dual designed all of our modules, so if the balloon went up on a Wednesday while we were delivering, we could actually get to the end of the week. Probably wouldn't be a great experience for the students, but we could actually get to the end of the week without having to tell the poor old students, go away, come back heaven knows when. And that's where we've built everything up that we've done.
Okay, so can you give us a sense then of what did change and what had to move online and what that meant for your delivery?
There were various things that changed. The one that all of us have found the most difficult is actually the lecturing side. For very good and fine reasons, very few students like having their cameras on. So you end up talking to a blank screen of initials and you get no feedback from the energy level in the room if students are asleep or writing down with great excitement every pearl of wisdom that you say. That we found very difficult to transition into. We tend to leave our cameras on, and I've noticed I've developed a habit because I've got no face to look at on the screen. I tend to sort of start to look down. I don't have any notes, but look where my notes would be, which means any students who are looking at the camera are now staring at my bald spot. So I've had to be very careful in moving away from looking down and trying to focus on the camera. So I've got a big sheet of paper saying, look here, just above my monitor where my camera's positioned. The other thing that we had real difficulty with, mostly since COVID, we didn't have this prior to COVID, was student interactivity. And we actually found in our first few in late autumn 2019, before COVID kicked off, we had more questions from students than we would in a classroom. And we'd put this down to the kind of security of pseudo-anonymity, that if nobody knows who you are, asking a question of saying, I really didn't get that, no one's going to tease you about it at the coffee break later. And we had far more questions come in. However, we noticed once we were back in the main routine that went away. And the other huge challenge we've had was to get students to interact, particularly during lectures. We've never subscribed to some kind of, we're pouring a jug of water of knowledge into the cup of the student's brain. We've always tried to make it a two-way discussion, and that's been an extremely hard barrier to break, and I don't think we're there yet. The other major challenges we had was we had a physical board game, which was a simulation that we ran, and in a bit of a panic, I had to turn that into a horrifically complicated Excel spreadsheet and then teach the students how to use somebody else's Excel spreadsheet to mixed results, but it kind of worked in the end. But otherwise, most of it's business as usual. Once you get your head around allowing a bit more time for everything and getting the students used to where you've decided to put all the documents and where to find things, it's been okay.
Thanks for that then. So can I ask you about some of the specifics? It's always interesting to know about the actual tools that you're using, because they can vary across the university. Am I right to think that you're using a mix of Moodle and Teams and anything else?
Yep, that's right. So we decided to set Teams up in a skeuomorphic fashion, so it followed the way that students would be in a normal WMG learning environment, where we have, we call them lectures, in reality they're seminars. We tend to teach to groups of about 20 to 30, and we would normally put them into syndicates of 4, 5, 6 students, depending on what the exercise is, so they'd have syndicate rooms. So first of all, within Teams, we designated a channel for each of the rooms that we'd have had, and a separate channel for a register, so that we could keep the students under control where they were going. We also interface with Moodle, and we run that interface both ways. So our Moodle courses in finance have a lot of pre-learning for students, which is a series usually of talking head style videos interspersed with a bit of stock footage and some PowerPoint to get across the general concepts of finance that they need before we can start talking to them. And from there, we divide them up into their different module instances. There's about 900 students this year that we'll be teaching in groups of 30. So we divide them up into those different groups. We then allow them within their Moodle to have restricted access just to their group's items that they're working on, and that gives them a link to the team that they will be located in. And we manually build the teams because we found it easier as we've got lots of syndicate rooms to set up. Moodle links to the teams, and within Teams we have a dedicated tab on the landing page, the general channel, which links back to Moodle. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Students need to log in. And occasionally, for whatever reason, it falls apart. Teams is not a great browser.
Can I just ask you then about video? Generally interested in perhaps how you serve that and what system and process you use for that.
Certainly. The videos I did over the summer, and myself and my colleagues worked out what content, first of all, we felt was appropriate to give to students when they've never met us. There's no relationship between us and the students, so as I said, it's very backgroundy. And I chunked concepts of finance and accounting into about 7 to 10 minutes. I think the longest one's 11 and a half minutes. I recorded the videos, as I said, doing a talking head. And I use some video editing software to drop in some stock footage. So if I'm talking about a factory, it's just quite nice to have a picture of a drone flying through a factory. So I subscribe to a stock footage website, which I've managed to get some copyright-free stock footage from. That we present on Moodle, and we do it through a variety of things. So there's sort of a start video, and from that it asks them to answer questions using the Moodle. I can't remember if it's a quiz or a lesson, but it's a branching type of approach. So if they get it right, they can. If they get the questions right, they can progress on to the next topic, which is a 10-minute video followed by a series of branching questions. Linked into that, we have a Kahoot competition for them, where there's just a quiz and we score it the same as any other Kahoot. So the person who gets it right the fastest gets the most points. It's really just to engage them as much as anything else. And we tried to get them to complete a Padlet, which they've been rather reticent to do. So they're quite happy doing the Kahoot, but they've not been very happy completing a Padlet to try and link up the different concepts that we have. That once they've completed that, they start the course, and we just make it very clear to them we don't teach anything on that. So if they do need support, every Monday afternoon at 3:30, I have an open Teams meeting which they can just drop into and chat to me, or they can send me emails, or they can contact me via the chat on Teams.
That's great. And it's interesting to reflect on what you're saying there, because it sounds like you're clearly presenting a mix of asynchronous recorded material and live sessions. Do you have a view on that, and which work best or which are more appropriate for what context, you might say, bearing in mind that in the back of my mind and that of others, that sometimes there isn't much difference between the live session and the recorded session unless there's some form of interactivity. So do you have any comments or thoughts on that?
We are not, I don't think, going to get rid of the asynchronous material as and when we get back to full-on face-to-face teaching. We've actually found it a really good tool to, well, it's not quite flip the classroom, but it's almost there. We can get the students up to a level and then do questions with them on day one, rather than spending time going through basics, which they can do at their own pace. So that's worked really well. The anecdotal feedback from students is they prefer the live lectures, even though we've noted they don't seem to interact all that much. They very much prefer it, and they give us feedback. And I prefer giving live lectures because it allows me to bring in things that have happened during the week. So because we're dealing with business and finance, there's always something relevant that's happened in the news the day or the day before that we can bring in, and that makes it a bit more real for the students. There's also certain concepts which I'm really struggling to 10-minute chunk. This is not based on any science, but my belief is it's unlikely a student is going to sit and watch an hour and a half of me trying to explain some abstract financial concept, whereas if I can talk them through it, do an example of a little bit, get them to work in a syndicate to teach each other, come back to the lecture room, just like I would in a physical setting, that works better than the asynchronous style. So that's a very long-winded way of saying it's horses for courses.
That's good. And can you say something more about any feedback and perhaps how the students are coping with that? What's the student experience as far as you know?
I think it's diminished, which is understandable and expected. The general feedback has been positive, that I think particularly before this academic year, the students were expecting an extreme low bar of quality because they were perfectly well aware that, you know, this was a black swan event. It was something nobody was expecting. And we'd exceeded that just by being half competent rather than being utterly useless. And then this year, we took the view we didn't think we'd be teaching face-to-face, so we designed everything and had the summer to work on it to be online only. And that's paying off now. We can soon flip back to being in the classroom, but it's paying off now having everything as online only. And as a result, I don't think it's been that bad for the students. There's things they like. They like that we tend to teach around their time zones. So we've tried to group students so they're loosely in the same time zone, so they're not staying up till 2 a.m. And at the same time, it's allowed us, when we do teach overseas into overseas centres, to have a change of voice. So before all this kicked off, if we went to overseas centres, it'd be one lecturer for a week. And that's brutal on both the lecturer and, to be honest, the students, if they happen not to like that lecturer for whatever reason. And now we've got a change of voice because it's easily within our budget to have every member of the finance team deliver a session or two and sit and chat. Well, not sit and chat, but you know what I mean, chat to the students. And that's been an enhancement. I've been far more available than I would have been normally. So our modules work that we have a fairly intensive week. then the students go away and they have roughly 60 hours worth of week to, of time to do an essay of some form. And I've been far more available to chat to students, which I don't really know why that's happened, but it just seems to be that I'm able to make far more time to have one-to-one conversations with students over Teams rather than trying to book a room and sitting down with them. And we never really spoke on the phone to students beforehand. Occasionally they'd hit me on WeChat or something, but that was it.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. And I've read something about that recently, about that availability. And part of the answer, I suppose, obviously, is the efficiency of this type of communication tool. As you say, you don't have to be somewhere and you don't lose that time, and students aren't late, and perhaps you don't have to build in so much in between time as well. But that's interesting to hear. Any other comments, discussion, anything we haven't had a chance to mention that we should squeeze in?
I think I'd say don't be scared to experiment. We've tried a variety of things with students and they're all perfectly aware that a lot of what we're doing is fairly experimental, because you know this is quite unprecedented, and as a result they tend to be more forgiving if things don't work perfectly first time. And quite a few of the experimental things we've done haven't quite worked, but the students said, actually, if you just do this and this, it'd be really good. So don't be scared to experiment. Practice speaking to a blank screen or blank PowerPoint or something, because it is soul destroying if you're doing it for the first time, and I'm sure that shows in your vocalization and everything else. And don't be scared to ask. So if people want help or tips or something, get in contact with me. I'm more than happy to help.
Brilliant. Thanks for your time, Lee. Always good to catch up, and thanks for sharing an insight into your experiences.
You are most welcome.
Well, how about that? I'm very grateful to our contributors in this episode, Alexa, Chloe and Lee. I consider myself privileged to be able to have these professional discussions and to hear about the different ideas and experiences. It's also good to reveal some of the unexpected occurrences and events and hear about some of the problems and things that don't always work out. But that means we can all learn from each other, and hopefully that means we can continue to improve what we do on behalf of our students. I normally reward anyone who has made it this far with a bonus technology fact or tip, but this time I've had an email from Joe in the Faculty of Social Sciences, and they want to know where the name Moodle comes from. Well, would you believe, Joe, the word was previously used to describe the action of dawdling aimlessly to idle away time, although its origin isn't clear. But more commonly, and certainly since the year 2000, Moodle is also the name of the virtual learning environment, the VLE. It gets its name from Modular Object-Oriented Dynamic Learning Environment. Moodle. But how about this for an amazing twist? I've checked this myself. The creator of Moodle, Martin Dougie Amos, who is based in Perth, Australia, has a family pet dog. And what breed do you think it is? You may have guessed it, it is a Moodle. That's right, it is a breed that comes from mixing the Maltese and miniature poodle genetics. So how about that? Well, you've definitely learned something, and I think that's probably enough. So thanks for listening. Stop, 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 stop